Alan Kring Productions, in association with the Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is International Financial Management, FIL 344, for spring semester 2022. Today, managing economic risk, and part of this has to do with divisional analysis, seeing if you have different divisions operating in different countries. It's surprising to see that sometimes one division has a much greater exposure to economic risk than another division does. And that would have a lot to do with what are the policies within a division as far as using resources from other countries, selling to other countries, where the costs are incurred, where the bonds are issued, and all this kind of stuff. But it is a useful analysis. And the one I'm doing here in Excel was actually the original that was for the book and for the PowerPoint. But in the PowerPoint, and in the book obviously, but in the PowerPoint, everything was turned into a text so that you just can't copy it and paste it into Excel. You actually have to retype everything in if you don't have it. I have the original Excel sheet, and I stripped off, for the purposes of this class, I stripped off the back sheets that did the regression analysis so you could see me do it and see me once again fail at doing it, like I usually do when I try to do these things in the classroom. But anyway, just having a quick look at everything that's happy and going on around the world. Right now, as you can see, the ruble is beginning to slide back off again. And I would imagine, well, what I've been told is that this is probably going to keep going. The ruble is going to begin to let up some now. They managed to get a substantial amount of buying in rubles over the past couple of weeks, but that seems to have finished up, and so now they're back where they were. And there's also the concern now of a default that they are going to carry out in the near term. As I believe it was Standard & Poor's Global has now issued a warning of a default coming on a Russian obligation. Now, Russia is saying, well, we're just going to pay it in rubles. And the rest of the world is saying, no, you can't do that, you see, because you are required by the bond contract to pay in euro and in dollars. So you can't just say, we'll pay in euro. It doesn't work that way. You need to use your rubles to buy the other currency, and then from there, you pay us in that other currency, like an American dollar. And they're saying, no, we're just going to pay you directly in rubles. And then they had the cheek to say, we'll decide how much a ruble is worth to the euro and to the dollar, which is actually kind of cool. I think I'll try that sometime myself. But there you are. Okay, now looking over, now Canada. Now I haven't looked at this. I deliberately did look at this. I want to see what's going to happen. Canada just announced, the central bank just announced, that it would be the first central bank of the developed G7s that was going to do a half point increase in their discount rate. We've been piddling around with the quarters, quarter, and others have too. They're saying, no, we're just going to go, we're going to go to the wall and, take the whole thing. So let's see what happens. Canada, if this is really an efficient market, we should see the Canadian dollar appreciate relative to the U.S. dollar. And survey says, kiss my... okay. Apparently that... Well, there... Here I am sitting here talking, spouting what obviously should happen, and that ain't what happened at all. It declined. What the hell? Did they suddenly run out of maple syrup and everyone's pissed at them? That didn't work. To put it like a Canadian would, well, that didn't work, eh? Jeez, I mean, it plunged. Heck, okay, fine. Maybe they, just out of curiosity, let's see what the euro is doing right now. By the way, there is a purpose to this every day. The more I do this, the more you get used to it, and you're not thinking your way through it. You're just sort of seeing, ah, I see it. And as you get exposed to this more and more, it begins to make sense on a less than top of the brain level. As you can see, down. NZ, it's a New Zealand dollar. Let me see. Yeah, because they decided they were going to get butch here, didn't they? As a matter of fact, what did they just do? They just kicked out someone from their country, New Zealand dollar. Well, isn't that interesting? It didn't take the plunge. That's interesting. So New Zealand apparently is seen as prospective that they're serious. Glad you brought that one up. Let me see the yen here. Just out of curiosity, how's the yen doing? Oh, that's just diving. I mean, well, yeah, they do. They're telling the rest of the world, you're a mama-san. I mean, okay, fine. Now, go over here. Just now, the euro. Did I look at the euro already? Yeah, I did. That one plunged. And then, oh, I want to see the yuan. Oh, pound sterling. I mean, Boris did some. What the heck is going on? I mean, they did punish him with a fine for having that lockdown party, and I mean, they should have punished the other people there for thinking that Boris would be fun at a party. What was the one? Oh, the Chinese yuan. Renminbi yuan. Boing, 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 boing. Pushed up a little bit, but I mean, it's nothing spectacular, but it's got a lot of strength. Notice something. Do you see how really volatile that little son of a thing is? It is a volatile, the yuan is. And didn't used to be. It used to be a flat line because they peg. And they've taken off some of the stops, but interestingly enough, it just created extraordinary volatility. Now, think about it this way. If you are a multinational company and you use a lot of outsourcing to China, back in the day, it was awesome for outsourcing American production over to the mainland because you knew there wasn't an exchange rate problem. There was no transactional risk, no economic risk. The yuan was 8.28 to the dollar. And then they started to decouple it, and they said they were before they really got down to business with it. But since then, these companies that were over there doing all their production, laughing their asses off because they got cheap labor and all this, and suddenly it's begun to let go, and those companies are really in a lot more trouble now than they used to be, simply because that currency is now subject to, as you can see, pretty wild economic exchange rate fluctuations. And those are the kind, notwithstanding what I'm teaching you the last few weeks and today, those are the kinds of things that hedging doesn't, it's hard to hedge. Why is it hard to hedge? Because it is really hard to get, okay, this is what I've heard, it is really hard to get forward contracts in yuan against the dollar. I mean, forwards are one of your best ways to do it. But in this case, it's not all that easy. The other part of that was that for a long, long time, you remember the money market hedging I told you about, how you can borrow in one currency and then deposit it and then get it back and turn it back into the currency you want? That was something that was very commonly done in Hong Kong back in the day. In 1999, the Great Britain essentially handed over Hong Kong to the Chinese. And there was a period when we were reasonably assured that mainland China, Beijing, was going to leave its hands off Hong Kong. Let Hong Kong be Hong Kong, a very modern Western country. Have any of you ever been to Hong Kong? Oh, I mean, it is just spectacular. You just, oh my God. That's a city. No, that's a planet. It's like something almost out of science fiction. The buildings are gorgeous. It's lit up all night, every night, and along the water. It's just shimmering. And then the Chinese decided they didn't like all of the freedom that Hong Kong had, and they've been cracking down. And that has made Hong Kong less desirable as a haven for depositing money, for using it for money market hedging. It has just lost its luster a lot. One of the things that a lot of conservative economic and business types say is authoritarian regimes are always better than more liberal democracies, because in an authoritarian regime, you've got more certainty, they're more pro-business and all of that. Interestingly enough, especially in the last decade and a half, that sentiment is actually changing. We have plenty of economic experience now that authoritarian regimes seems almost contradictory. They are actually less reliable, less reputable in terms of economic development. Part of that is because authoritarian regimes tend to be corrupt AF. That's a big part of it right there. Another part of it is that authoritarian regimes, they tend not to move with the information that's brought to them. They say, this is the way it is. We know better than the economists, the business people, and all of that. And hence, as a result, economic reality does not impact them as nearly as quickly as it does in a liberal democracy. In the liberal countries of Europe and more liberal countries of Asia and of obviously the United States and Canada. So there's a little bit of background for you. Now let me get down to the business here of talking about what we're doing today. Okay. This is a repeat of what I was talking about last time in the class. Is essentially your job is to maximize the value of the firm. That's the only thing that matters. You are there for the shareholders. Never mind all this talk about the stakeholders and that kind of stuff. Your job is to make that firm as valuable as possible. One of the ways that you make a firm more valuable is to lower its risk. Risk is the largest source of price depreciation of stock. The higher the risk, the higher the expected return. So if the price goes down, you expect it to jump more. But that means the price has to go down as risk goes up so that it can have that jump upward. That is just a fundamental rule of finance. So our job here in dealing with exchange rate risk, transactional risk, economic risk, whatever you want, a risk of having a return to disco, you need to find ways to get that risk down. So that's all this is saying to you. It's what I've preached before in this class. In other words, let's get the volatility of our cash flows under control. As you saw in the last lecture, that might mean that your best performance under a highly volatile exchange rate might be awesome, but also your worst performance might be really, really bad. So in other words, oftentimes with risk mitigation, decreasing risk in exchange rate exposures of all kinds, is to actually sacrifice some of what you would make in your best case scenarios without management. But that also elevates your worst case scenarios, and overall, you have a lower risk profile. That's just the reality of it. I promise you that on the final exam, I'm going to ask you this. It is kind of an obvious point. Don't let me bluff you on that. You want to reduce risk. If that means a little bit of sacrifice, you, sir, you are an insane man right now, and you, I don't even want to talk about you. Someday, you two are going to be really boring people. Someday. I mean, well, Someday, you're going to wear a dad sweater vest. You're going to drive an SUV. And you're going to have a picture of mommy and daddy and the kids on the stenciled on the back. And you are going to say to your kids, might be right for some, but it ain't for our family. And those kinds of things. And when your kid comes in with piercings, you're going to have a fit. Are you out of your mind? Okay. Have you seen a new piercing right on the front of the nose? It's a ball that goes there. It's a ball. And then it prongs out and you put in the clasps underneath on both sides. Yeah. They're septal, but the ball is sitting on the front. What the hell is that for? I don't even want to think about. I know what that would be for, but it's really disgusting. God. Anyway, let me get back to this. Try to stay on task here, people. Okay. Now, I'm going to take you over to an Excel sheet. And as I said, I try this, and God knows every time I try this, I get my ass kicked. We're going to look at a company that has three different divisions. All three of them are involved in multinational operations. And we're going to look at it, break it down in terms of where the exposure really is. And these are percentage changes by unit in their free cash flows. And we're going to look at that based upon the change in the value of the euro, where they all have these international operations. So in order to do that, we are going to use the data analysis pack, analyze data. And they are making it really stupid here. This is not, okay. No, I don't want that. For God's sake, all I want to do was a regression, for heaven's sake. Okay. I want to see the change in the value of the euro. This is not how it used to be done. It's done on mine, but I think I can figure this out. Okay, update. No, I want to do it the other way. For God's sake. Let's try this one more time. It's trying to decide for me what I want to do. How many different percent change in total cash flow of unit A? Well, okay. I'm out. They're trying to decide for me what I want, and I don't want that, so I'm just going to do it the old-fashioned way. I'm going to try to do it by a line estimate. Equals line est. Okay, the known y's. We're going to look at unit A changes against the changes in the value of the euro. The euro is going to be the independent variable here. Okay, so now true for the y-intercept and true for the extended statistics, even though I don't want them. In this one? See, that's what I hate about this way of doing it. It doesn't explain to you what the different numbers are. Let me do something here. Let me do false so that I don't get all this nonsense. False. Now, I am still not as familiar as I would like to be with this, the line est. I'm familiar with the analyze, but it's just these regressions, the way it's doing it in this version of Excel. It used to be you just said it would just give you, show me where your independent variable is, show me where your dependent variable is, and then it would go from there. In this one, let me try, I know how I can find out something here. Line est, and I'm going to false this one. And that'll tell me which one was the y-intercept. Yeah. Okay. So, what we're seeing here is essentially what this is telling us, if the y-intercept is zero. This is saying that there is a negative relationship of about 0.275, about a little more than a fourth of the free cash flow of unit A swings against the value of the euro. Changes in the value of the euro up cause about a 27% decrease in changes in the free cash flows of unit one, unit A. Okay? So if we go through here and do the same thing, equals line estimate. Really uncomfortable with this, but okay, so that would be, oops, I spelled that wrong. Line est, E-S-T, open parenthesis, and the known y's, the euro, against division B, and we'll do a false, so we don't get all the extra statistics in there. What did I do wrong here? Let's try it again. The known changes in unit B for a given change in the euro. C10, you're right. I so suck at doing this in front of people. It's sort of like taking a bath. I can't do it in front of other people. Don't you wish, Sparky? There we go. Well, isn't that strange? The change in the unit C against the euro. Once you get this down, it's kind of fun to do. Well, isn't that interesting here? Is that unit A, the free cash flows move against the euro. Units B and C, the free cash flows move with the euro. Now, that's an odd thing. And they are, unit C is really sensitive. Do you see that? With the euro's movements, unit C is where we have our most problem with economic risk exposure. Now, that's not trivializing unit B. Unit B, that's column C here. Unit B is pretty volatile too. Unit A, it is damaged considerably by the volatility of the euro. So what would be the interpretation of this? Why would unit A work against the exchange rate volatility and units B and C be highly sensitive and move up and down with it? Go ahead. Yahtzee. A doesn't. A actually benefits and does not get hurt. In a case like what we're seeing here, by the way, this is going to be up in your resources tab so that you can goof around with it and do some interesting things if you want. But it's telling me that Units B and C are far more dependent upon euro payments and euro revenues or whatever. We are not really all that thrilled about that, especially when you have that. And Unit C is the one that is the big, big problem here, is that its free cash flows are going to swing almost 50% with the volatility of the euro. So in a case like that, your first focus of realignment would almost unquestionably be to get after Unit C, the Division C, and figure out what we can do to hedge some of that exchange rate volatility there. And then we go after Unit B next, based upon our experience with what is happening with Unit C. Unit B is just an oddball. It's almost hard to call. Its free cash flows actually are harmed by calmness in the market. That would say that we are probably have got some way in Unit A that they are taking advantage of exchange rate volatility in one way or another. They might actually be hedging. They're over-hedging, but that might be the result of hedging. So I'm going to save this right here, and then I'm going to upload it, this new version, into your files. What do you mean you can't save it? Let me put it here in your documents. Okay, I'll just put it there, and then I'll upload this so that you can work with it yourself. But in any event, if you can possibly do it, and I promise you it's easier, download the data analysis pack, and the way you do that very quickly, file, and then you go down here to, I think it's to your options, add-ins. And it gives you all of these very fun things. Some of them are just fun. Some of them are really useful for you to use, especially in more advanced courses. Power pivot tables are great for things. The equation solver is something almost out of a dream. You can give it an extraordinarily complex equation, and you're needing to solve some variable that's inside of the equation that you can't separate out and put on one side. It'll do it for you. It'll just keep working until it finds what the solution to a big equation is, where you know the one side, you know everything on the other side except for one mean thing that you can't tease out. And it'll go through and it'll find it for you in that solver, the equation solver. That is hugely useful in some areas of finance, especially if you go on a little bit and go for that dream PhD that you're all thinking about. Or not. But just know it's the add-ins, and then you just choose your data analysis pack. Do you know what a pivot table is?
Yeah.
This does it, except actually pivot tables are way overrated, the ones that most people use, because it can do only a very few things like summations of columns and all that. The power pivot tables make a pivot table so that it can do a lot of things like sum products, multiplications and things like that in the pivot table itself. And it's a much better thing than these pivot tables that everyone says, oh, everyone should be using pivot tables. And also the power pivot does power pivot charts too. Pivot tables are great, but if you can use a pivot table to make charts, you've got something that's a real winner, because you can do multiple charts very fast based upon different what-ifs on the pivot. And so these are definitely ones. And Euro currency tool, I should take the time to show you how that one works. But essentially, it's a way, if you know how to use it right, if all your operations are in euros, you can figure out how to do hedging off this Euro, off that Euro pack. So anyway, these are fun. Now the VBA, I don't know, are any of you familiar with VBA? We used to call VBA Virus Builder because you could write viruses in it and make people really sad when they opened Excel. But now you can't do that with it. But VBA, you can write your own scripts so that you can write these awesome macros that do a whole bunch of things just by clicking a button instead of you going through and doing repetitively the same thing over and over again from one time to the next. I use a VBA script to, every time I open an Excel sheet, it downloads the latest column of data from a data source. And that's huge once you get out there and you're updating stock market data. As soon as you open the Excel sheet, boom, it goes and finds the data and it updates it for you right away. And it'll do that for any kind of data. If you can tell it where to find data, it'll just say, I'm going to go get the new data. And zoom, it's there for you. Okay, but anyway, cancel that. Taking you out of this, and I this is pretty stupid Petrick stuff, but actually, this is more or less, now obviously these are simplified values. They'd probably be percent changes to two decimal places or something like that. But at the same time, you are going to collect data for a period of a certain number of periods. How many quarters are a great thing to use, quarterly? How many should you use? No fewer than eight. Here are you nine. So use enough data so that you get some reliability in these numbers right here and take them seriously. Because as you can see in this one, it is showing you some dramatic differences among the different divisions and their exposures. And you're saying, well, if you average those out, not necessarily. You might find that over a reasonable period of time, your unit C is your biggest free cash flow positive. It's the winner. But remember that that is, remember those lines I showed you. You might just be seeing an unusual period with the exchange rate. The whole idea, again, is to get these numbers lower. Are you going to get them to zero? Absolutely not, and you probably don't want to either, because the cost of doing that in terms of what you'd have to do for hedging or whatever, and the opportunity cost of the time of the personnel to keep after this that tightly would be not worth it. But you do want to set up some kind of a policy. We want, within a certain number of periods, we want unit C to come down from 0.41 to 0.35. Now, obviously, you've got that lagging data in there that's going to be affecting it for some time. Essentially, it's a moving average. But you say we want the moving average of that beta that's on that unit C in the regression. We want that down to 0.35. And then you just say, okay, what are you going to do to accomplish this? And that pushes them to start doing the hedging or the money markets or the forward contracts. And yes, forwards in euros are just so common, it's ridiculous. You can call up about any multinational bank and just say, I want to do hedging for my free cash flows against euro, and they'll put you with the person who will do it. Say, tell me what you want. Send me your financials so we can have a look at what we're facing here and how much you can afford, how much hedging do you want to accomplish? Do you want to do complete hedging, or do you want to do a partial hedge and all that kind of stuff? Enough of that. Let me take you over here and finish this up. Here's an interesting thing, is dealing with exposure on your fixed assets. Now, you eventually probably want to put in fixed assets and you want to dispose of fixed assets in other countries. This is an important area of consideration. How do you hedge against this for the long term? These would be long-term forward contracts. This is a funny thing. There was a complete lack of any effort to hedge long-term of companies that were American and some European companies that were building business in Russia. No effort whatsoever to deal with the long-term problem that would cause. They didn't see anything possible that could happen. Even though we have had, since easily since 2014, the political financial analysts have been saying there's going to be a blow up. We are going to have it. Russia took Crimea. Do you really think they're going to stop with Crimea and we're just going to sit there and that'll be the end of it? Do you really think Vladimir Putin, who has a history of assassinations, political intrigue, agitprop in Western countries, all these Western intelligence agencies have been talking about it since 2012. Do you really think that's going to be the end of it? They ignored it. Wow, we've got a McDonald's now in Moscow, and all that kind of stuff. Well, spank me Jesus. Now here we are, and they have no hedge, and they've lost everything, these companies have. Their balance sheets are looking not too pretty for those operations that now no longer exist. All they would have to have done back when things were quiet was to have gotten some long-term forwards on rubles against dollars. That's all they would need to have done, is to have dealt with it back then. Well, that costs money. Why would we have spent money on those kinds of forward contracts? Because, Cupcake, what happened? Well, how could we possibly have known? Because you didn't pay attention to the intel. And that's one of the things about multinational operations. Just a quick mention here. You are in the world of spy works. You need to get intelligence reports. That's part of what you do. I don't care if it's on allies as well as adversaries. Get regular, weekly, monthly, whatever, intelligence reports from the spooks. They hand them out like candy, for God's sake. And if you want to spend some money, you've got some of the most awesome people I've known who can call these things well in advance. They have these actual indexes of risk, risk index by country, and they cover about any country in the world, the risk index. You can use that as your basis for decision making on forwards versus no forwards, hedging, whatever. And once you say, okay, this risk index has gone to a point where internally we need to deal with it, they didn't do it. As the joke goes, what Vladimir Putin called Obama right after he had taken over Crimea, and Putin said, "Hey, Barack, knock, knock." And Obama said, "Who's there?" And Putin said, "Crimea." And Obama said, "Crimea who?" And Putin said, "Crimea River." Stupid. Okay. Here's the problem, and this was, of course, the thing that was going on with, don't get me wrong, I'm not trashing Obama. He was, at that time, he was an internationalist in a very popular sense, but he didn't see it in the tight political sense. Okay, hedging, here's the problem. When? I mean, we got the warnings as late as, clearly, there was trouble. 2014, 2015, we knew there was going to be trouble with Russia. But when was it going to blow up? Should we get long forwards for 2 years, 5 years, 10 years? When? What's our time frame? The answer to that, usually for companies who are managing political, potential economic political risk in transactions, is to look at renewing contracts about every 3 years. Let it expire and then renew. And that would be with futures contracts. You can get them out as long, long term. They're kind of expensive, but at the same time, gee, that's not quite as expensive as having Russia take over your entire operational framework in their country that you put into place because you were too stupid to pay attention. And there's the other thing, too, is, okay, a forward contract or a futures contract, you need to know. It's best if you have a good estimate of where it's going to be at expiration, where this is going to end up at the expiration date. How do you predict that? We're educated. We're going to give our best. We're going to say educated judgment. That's a fancy way of saying we're guessing. Okay? But we have a little bit more intelligence to guess a little bit better than the average person does. One of the things that is often done in this last line here is you look at historical information. How bad has it gotten in the past? That's sort of like at least a good way of thinking about a worst case scenario, is how far did the ruble fall at a time in history? How high did the euro get at a certain time in history? Those kind of give you a guidance on your worst case scenario, and then you can shape it from inside there. And a lot of companies put a probability scale together. 0.10, it's really bad. 0.10, it's incredibly good. And then in the middle, you have the rest of the probability distribution. For kind of bad, just okay, kind of good. And then you put together an expected value. And then you use that. And you adjust it from time to time. Coming off that one and bitching at you a little more. This is just your financial statements. Your translational risk is your financial statements. And this is the one I already talked about. If it's just translational, understand that this is where we have to get the difference between the financial statements and the free cash flows. I've bitched at you in my classes about it. I hope you've heard it from other professors as well, is that the net profit is not free cash flow. It is actually not even related in a way to free cash flow. I can show you, I consulted for companies. I could make those financials, the net profit line, look great, knowing very well that company was going to close its doors in 2 years. And I didn't have the time because they'd hired me too late. They knew something was wrong. All we are really talking about here in translational exposure is the numbers that are on the income statement and the balance sheet. They will have an effect down the line. So, for example, if I have receivables exposure in another country, well, that's going to show up as a change in net operating working capital, which does affect free cash flow. So at that point, there are two things. One is here. You hedge that with, futures or forward contracts. The other thing is, ask yourself, this is more of a corporate finance thing anyway. Do we really get that much out of having high receivables? Why would we have high receivables? Most likely we have easy terms of credit. You can pay us in 6 months. Sure, you're probably going to get their business. But what does that do to your receivables? And what does that 6-month lag going further? How does that expose you to translational risk in your financials? So in other words, this isn't just about hedging the exposure with forwards and futures. It's also about answering the more basic question. Are the receivables on our balance sheet in line with the industry? Are they really what we want? The same is true of payables. Are those really in line with the industry? Are we paying too quickly? Are we waiting too long to pay? Ask yourself those kinds of questions. That goes down to that changes in net operating working capital kind of thing. The same is also true on the long-term balance sheets, the long-term assets. How much exposure do we have to fixed assets over in other countries? Do we really want that? How much exposure do we have to fixed assets in our own country? Okay. So that's, and then on the long-term debt side, it also comes down to, is our debt equity structure appropriate for the industry? Are we at the minimum of weighted average cost of capital? So in other words, I'm teaching you in an international finance course, but there are more fundamental issues going on here about your fixed asset space, about your debt level as opposed to your equity level. And then from there, okay, we've got a debt level that is too high. Does that debt level have a lot of transactional exposure in other countries? In other words, are we borrowing money because it's cheaper in Europe? Well, that might not be the case later. This was an interesting thing that's happened in the past 5-8 years, is that more companies are seeking capital overseas. They're raising, they're denominating in euros because there is a lot of money in Europe. And they denominated in euros. And there were other reasons why they denominated in euros as well. There were some IBs, European IBs, that were open for business. They said, you come to us and we'll hook you up with debt capital. And so a lot of companies went over there, denominated in euros, and here they are exposed to euro volatility. And that has gotten rather serious recently, as you can see from that data on those charts. Last thing, here's your problems. Obviously, your forecasts. When you get into a corporate environment, they're going to say, just do it this way. Do a time series, that's all. Do a payback period, that's all. Don't kill yourself on this. And in fact, they will even, you'll find some of the heads of, I know a treasurer, she just had a fit because this real hot shot was in there. He took over and he was doing all of these earnings forecasts using econometric methods. I mean, from what I understand from his brief descriptions, he was using state-of-the-art forecasting. And it's damn good forecasting. And it requires some pretty heavy computer time, too. But the treasurer, the CFO, she just had a fit. She was making fun of him, berating him. Why did you do that? We've got a button. Here, here, here. And she's an asshole that way. Here, here. See, push that button and you get the forecast. Well, what's that forecast? And he said, from what I could tell, that was just a time series. In other words, if it's trending upward, the next one will trend upward, you know, by the same percentage. It's not an analysis. And so she fired him, and he got a job with an investment banking firm in Manhattan. So they're both happy, but be aware that you've got uncertainty. The only way to bring down your uncertainty is through using best practices, and also becoming educated and becoming knowledgeable about what the pitfalls are in your earnings forecasts. And another thing is accounting. Are you familiar with the term mark-to-market? Okay. Old time, FASB, since Jesus walked the earth. Jesus was on the FASB board, you know. He wasn't an investor. Jesus was more into the savings. I used to be a minister. My congregations didn't like that either. Okay, the hell with it. My brother was much better. He got the free will offerings. I just stood there. Okay, here we go. Marking to market says you take not the historical value of, let's say, an investment. We bought stock in this company, and we bought it at this book value, and that's what's going to show up on our financial statement. It came about only maybe 10 years ago that it was clear that this was a misrepresentation of value. You should mark to market. Put in the number for the value of that stock now. Not what you bought it for, not the book, but the market value. Your debt. Mark your debt to market. Okay, it was at 1,000 on the 1,000 when you issued it. Duh. You can't leave it there. What happens if your debt, you are now selling, that debt is selling at a premium to par? Let's say that debt is at 1091 to the 1,000. Your debt isn't 1,000 to the 1,000 anymore. If you issued $100 million in debt, the value of that debt is no longer $100 million. That debt is now $109,100,000, marking to market. That actually is great because that gives investors more of a real view of what's happening as far as current value of the corporation goes. It sucks here, though, because if you are marking the market based upon the euro's current value, well, your financial statement is going to be like a blur. Oh, no, whoa. 2 minutes to issue, one more update. It's going to be nonsense. So an accounting, I can't remember what the new one is. They're saying these days that the accounting standard is to take the moving average of the market value over the last four quarters, I think it is. So it's not pure mark-to-market just before you push the button to send them to the SEC. They say from the previous four quarters. So it's still historical, but it gives a little better picture of what the true value is right now. Any way you cut it, though, whether you're using book or you're using some kind of mark-to-market, it will have distortion in it. And the distortion is because the world itself is not an architect's dream. It is a blur. Tell you a weird story, and it seems like it has nothing to do with this. Did any of you, you're probably not old enough to have seen the original Batman movie in the new Dark Knights. It was like 15 years ago. Jack Nicholson was the Joker and all that kind of stuff. Well, they hired for the backdrops all of these architects and these incredible CAD machines to draw the Gotham City skyline behind which all the action was going to occur. And when they ran the film and in post-production, they said, this is ridiculously unrealistic. It looks stupid. It doesn't look like what the film noir of a Gotham City would look like. And there was some young twerp who was actually in art. He was pursuing his master's in art, who was on one of the set designers. He said, you need to do these, you need to hire impressionists to draw the backgrounds. That's how it would become real. And they thought about it, and they hired a couple from the university that was near the production. And that's what we see now, is those blurred, complicated backgrounds that look much more like what you would expect to see. The same is true here. The world is not an architecture. It is a moving, living animal. And so you have to appreciate that no matter what you do, you're going to have distortions. No matter how good you are at forecasting, you're going to be wrong. And there are going to be those who are going to say, well, you were wrong, and you are going to be very, very controlled. You're going to say, look, you asshole, I followed best practices. Find out what best practices are. And also, one last thing, as I had mentioned earlier, is that sometimes when you try to reduce one risk, you actually cause another risk to come into play, as I showed that to you last time, is that the more you try to manage some situations, the less accurate you're going to get with your overall exposures. And this goes, and I'll bore you with one more story. Have any of you been in the service? Okay, in the service, in training, they teach you how to scope with the rifle and point and kabam, like that. Well, I couldn't do it because I have Bell's palsy. You know, it's one of my eyelids droops. And there was an old sergeant, a staff sergeant. He said, come over here, son. I'm going to teach you Kentucky wind. Kentucky wind. Yeah. I said, well, they're going to yell at you. He said, I'll tell them to shut up. He was an E9, so he could. And he taught me how you don't point. You bounce and you flow, and then your body will know when to shoot. So don't think that perfection is going to be the best way. Sometimes Kentucky wind gets you the shot. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.